case number four. Vince versus Brandt Construction, Inc.
Your Honors, if I may proceed, my name is Stephen Garmisa. I'm here for Pamela Binns. This case boils down to the question of whether or not the role of Brandt Construction Company on the Sylvan Slaw Bridge crossing part of the Mississippi River was sufficient to trigger a duty of ordinary care under Illinois negligence law. The Brandt makes several factual assertions in support of its argument that it was entitled to summary judgment. First, Brandt argues that its employees ceased being Brandt employees under the loan servant doctrine. And the district court rejected that, even though Brandt is remaking that argument on appeal. The district court said, no, they weren't loaned employees because Brandt had a foreman who was on the job site functioning in a leadership capacity. So the court ruled the loan servant doctrine doesn't apply. This wasn't a situation where this was a day labor or a day labor company that just shipped out employees and turned them over. These people were on the job site using their Brandt had equipment on the job site. Brandt had 3, 4, 5 laborers, and Brandt had a foreman on the job site. In fact, the hourly rate that Brandt charged for his foreman was $28.50 an hour. The Brandt laborers were only $18.50 an hour. The district court concluded that the Brandt foreman was acting in a leadership capacity. Brandt also argues that it was not acting as a railroad contractor on the job site. And there was testimony by the railroad's engineering superintendent, Mr. Benton, that he hired Brandt because it was a railroad contractor. He testified that the railroad did not have sufficient equipment or laborers to do the tie replacement project that
Benton
had to be done.
Was an employee of who? Iowa Interstate.
Yes, sir.
All right. Who was the supervising person on the project?
The commander-in-chief was a railroad employee.
Or the railroad.
The railroad.
Are there any safety regulations on behalf of the federal government to provide safety devices for the employees?
There are regulations which the district court found that applied to Brandt. The district court said, no, they had employees there. They had a duty to comply with the safety regulations.
I said, are there any federal safety regulations that impose a duty on the employer to provide safety devices for the employees of another company?
Yes.
Of another company?
Yes.
Okay.
These regulations
did. What regulation are you referring to, please?
These are the regulations I cited. In the
Just tell me the section, if you will,
okay.
Please.
I start with section 214-105A6, which says the railroad or railroad contractor shall provide for prompt rescue of employees in the event of a fall. And I don't interpret that as meaning that if Brandt saw a railroad employee fall off the bridge, they could just wave to him goodbye. They had a duty under this regulation to provide, it doesn't say your own employees, it says any employees working on the bridge. And in order to look at the scope of the regulations, I go back to the introductory section, it's 49 Code of Federal Regulations 214.101 parent C. These provisions apply to all railroad employees, railroads, and railroad contractors performing work on railroad bridges. So I interpret that as meaning that anybody, they're working on the bridge they have a duty to comply with the regulations, including a duty that's owed to other employees, employees of other contractors.
To employees of other contractors.
Yes, sir.
This man was an employee of the interstate company?
Yes, sir.
And
interstate
you settled with them?
Yes, sir.
And now this is the action against Brandt, and that's the other employee.
Right.
And you're saying that Brandt also had the same duty?
Yes.
Right.
Yes. They had a duty to, they had an initial option under the regulations. They could have complied in two different ways. And the district court said
asking about the obligation. I'm not asking how they could have complied.
Okay. Yeah, no, it applied because they had a duty to provide rescue equipment. They had a duty to have ring buoys and a life-saving skiff. And that could have been used to save him because he was able to hold on to the bottom of the bridge. Once he fell into that hole, he was able to hold on long enough for his foreman to run and get other people to get help to run back there. He was screaming at John, hold on. Then he heard John fall and hit the water. They were able to run around to the side of the bridge, and they saw him going down. As they were wading out into the water, they were able to see him going down for the last time. And what I'm saying is, if this Brandt had a duty to have ring buoys and a life-saving skiff on that bridge, period. And that was, and I'm saying, the only sensible interpretation is it's got to be for the benefit of all the laborers, no matter who they work for, on that bridge site. They couldn't just say, well, that's not our employee, don't throw him a ring buoy. That's not our employee, don't get the life-saving skiff, let him go down. That's what that would, if they didn't have a duty to do that, then they could have just waved goodbye. And I'm saying
your opponent makes an argument that Brandt could have complied by supplying its employees
yes.
with individual
right.
devices. What is your reply?
And that gets back to the point I was going to make. That was their initial choice. They could have complied by supplying either a life-saving net, which would have saved John Binns, or they could have given their own people personal fall arrest systems. Personal fall arrest system.
Which wouldn't have affected him.
I think it would have because it would have changed the norm on that work site. It would have put to the lie the railroad's position and Brandt's position that this was minor work which did not require safety equipment under an exception to the regulations. So I'm saying that they went along with the program. Brandt went along with the program and didn't supply any life-saving or rescue equipment. And so that really, even if they had supplied personal fall arrest devices, then the railroad would have had to fall in line. But putting that aside, since they didn't supply either a safety net or a personal fall arrest devices for their own employees, then they had the duty to provide the ring buoys and the life-saving skiff, which I'm saying could have saved John Binns. I'm also saying, if you put aside the federal regulations, even if they don't apply, there was a common law duty under the Melchers decision.
How do you get around the Miller versus Archer Daniels decision?
Because in that
case, doesn't that hold that under Illinois law, a contractor who does not own or exercise any control over any portion of the work or the work site and is not in charge of the plaintiff's activities, does not owe the plaintiff a duty.
That's what it says. And that's the key point then on this appeal is, did Brandt have any role on this work site? Did Brandt have sufficient role on this work site? Excuse me?
It says is not in charge of the plaintiff's activity, or does it have control over any portion of the work or the work site dealing with him.
And I'm saying Brandt had control over this work site. sufficient to trigger the duty under the Melchers case and under Section 321 of the Restatement of Torts. Because Brandt had a foreman there, the district court said that, who was in a leadership capacity, and that's the quote from the district court. The Brandt foreman was acting in a leadership capacity. So the
were they done with their project on the bridge?
No, they were working in conjunction. They were
but
both working
they
together.
Done with that particular portion? Wasn't the Brandt firm done with their particular portion of it?
No, they were all working together. And they all had, it was all, they didn't, the work itself wasn't segregated to one partial part of the work to the other. But I'm saying that that's the key thing here. If you take all the reasonable inferences in favor of Pamela Binns, all the evidence and all reasonable inferences that Brandt had sufficient control over the work site to trigger the Melchers case and distinguish away the Miller's case. Because Brandt could have said, if there's no safety equipment here, no ring buoys, no life-saving skiff, we're yanking our laborers and we're yanking our equipment off of this work site. They had control. The Miller case, that person, that contractor, he had no control. I see the light is on. As to the rest of the arguments, if I may, Your Honor, I will rely on the briefs.
No, you have more time. That's your rebuttal time.
Right. I would like to save the rebuttal time.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
I'm sorry.
Okay, fine.
Yes.
But your time is
yes.
enough. Okay.
No, thank you, Judge.
May it please the Court, and good morning, Your Honors. My name is David LaPorte, and I represent the Appalachian Brandt Construction Company. There's nothing particularly difficult or novel about this case. It involves familiar principles of negligence, duty, breach of duty, proximate cause. After applying these very familiar bedrock principles of negligence law to the case at hand, it cannot be concluded that the trial court erred in granting summary judgment in favor of Brandt.
Isn't the heart of the problem, though, the fact that you had one of the employees who was titled foreman?
That's all that Brandt had, was one of the workers that Brandt supplied to the railroad, one of the workers that Brandt leased to the railroad, had the title of foreman. There is absolutely no evidence in the record establishing that this person functioned as a foreman. The evidence is just the opposite. The evidence is that this foreman took its direction and supervision and control from the Iowa Interstate supervisors on the job site. There's no evidence that this foreman exercised any direction and control over anyone at the job site. And it's the affidavit, the uncontradicted affidavit of Brandt's president, Mr. Terry Brandt, that nobody from Brandt Construction exercised any direction, supervision, or control over any of the workers.
Was there any evidence of why he was called a foreman?
That's not in the record, Your Honor, but he could have been functioning as an Iowa Interstate foreman. He could have been.
There's no evidence in the record.
Well, true. But you can't say that because he had the title of foreman that he was functioning as a foreman on the job site, or that, more importantly, that he was functioning as Brandt's foreman.
Was there any effort, one way or the other, to determine his role on the job site?
There was not. It's simply not in the record. What is in the record, though, is the affidavit of Brandt's president and also the deposition testimony of the Iowa Interstate supervisor, Mr. Bassett, who said that this foreman took direction, supervision, and control from Iowa Interstate. He answered to Iowa Interstate. He did not answer to Brandt.
Who is this foreman?
I'm not sure of the foreman's name. One of the workers that we provided.
Who was titled as the foreman.
Who was titled as a foreman.
But you don't know his name. All right, thank you.
I don't know his name off the top of my head.
Thank you.
Part of the inquiry here is what the contract was between Brandt and Iowa.
Correct.
There's an affidavit which says that this was a leasing of employees and specified equipment. I noticed in one part of the reply brief, page 11, they say that the railroad's engineering supervisor, testified he hired Brandt as railroad contractor to work on the project. Isn't that two kind of different contracts, that the testimony of those two people is somewhat in conflict?
The testimony of Mr. Benton, which I believe you're referring to, Your Honor, is that he hired Brandt because they needed workers and equipment to supplement their crew. He did not hire Brandt to perform the tie replacement project. That work was performed by Iowa Interstate. We merely leased to them workers and equipment.
So what you're saying then is that this part of the brief is inaccurate in saying there was testimony that he hired Brandt as a railroad contractor to work on the project. That sounds like Brandt had a almost a partnership type of responsibility.
I would refer the court to Benton's deposition testimony on page 44. Question: what was the understanding or arrangement for this project, the derailment project, regarding what Brandt would do and what Brandt's responsibilities were? Answer: we asked them to supply specific pieces of equipment in a designated workforce.
And you said
that's all that you asked Brandt to?
The other testimony that described here just didn't. There isn't that testimony.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I can refer the court to another portion of Mr. Benton's testimony. Now, Mr. Benton is Iowa Interstate's employee. Mr. Benton is the one with overall responsibility for the project. Mr. Benton is the Iowa Interstate employee who hired Brandt. Okay. Question: who was in charge as far as Brandt and the Iowa Interstate people of doing the work? Answer: we have supervisors out there that are in charge of the project. Question: did Brandt have any responsibility, or did they agree either for this project or any other project to have some safety responsibility, and specifically talking about fall protection? Answer: there was no agreement. Question on page 50 of Mr. Benton's deposition: did you call Brandt for their expertise, or did you call Brandt because they had men and equipment that you needed? Answer: I called Brandt because they had men and equipment available when I needed it. Well, for this part,
get back to what I understand. Okay. I mean, my understanding was that Vince was an employee of Interstate.
That's correct.
Had been prior to this job.
That's correct. That's correct. And there's no evidence in the record that Brandt ever exercised any direction, control, supervision at all.
Well, he wasn't a shared employee.
He was not a shared employee at all. If we told Vince where fall protection, Vince could have said, forget it, Brandt. I don't have to listen to you. We had no right or obligation to supervise Vince on the job site.
All right, proceed.
Our position, as far as the Federal Rail regulations go, we had no duty to comply with those regulations because we don't dispute that we were a railroad contractor. We had a contract with a railroad, but our contract was not to perform work on a railroad bridge. And we had no employees. We had nobody on the job site who we had any right to direct, supervise, or control. So we didn't have employees working on a railroad bridge. And we were not hired, and we were not performing work on a railroad bridge. I would submit that the lack of any authority to direct the means and manners in which the work on the railroad bridge was being performed precludes the finding that we were a railroad contractor performing work on a railroad bridge.
Your position is that Brandt Construction provided employees for whatever job that may come up in the maintenance?
That's correct. Once they were on the job site, they fell under the complete direction, supervision, and control of Iowa Interstate.
What do you have to say about the law that he says that there are two contractors on the bridge, each of them is responsible for all the employees?
I don't read the regulation like that, and the trial court didn't either. And in fact, I think even the plaintiff conceded in his initial brief to the court that the duty extended only to Brandt employees. Our position is that it didn't even extend that far because of the reason I articulated earlier. But assuming that it does,
how about the responsibility to put safety devices up? Do you agree that each employer had that responsibility independent of each other?
I do. Well, for the reasons I articulated earlier, we do not have an obligation to comply with the Federal Railroad Bridge Worker Safety Standard. And I think, too, that we get into a proximate cause argument, which I articulated in our brief.
I'm just asking you now. I know what's in your brief.
Right, okay, right. Assuming that we did, it's incumbent upon the evidence to put forth some evidence beyond mere speculation that if Brandt had provided the ring buoys and the man skiff, that bins would have been saved. We know that it was a fast-moving current. We know that Bins was dressed in work clothes. He was wearing work boots. He fell from about 28 feet. The current was swift. The depth of the river in that area was approximately 15 feet. To say that a man's skiff would have saved Bins, I think is just pure speculation.
Well, wouldn't the standard be whether it was more probable than not, rather than for sure it was he would have saved him?
I think the standard is that there has to be some evidence upon which it could be established to a reasonable degree of certainty that the man's skill and the ring buoys would have saved Ben. I think because of the factors in the depth of the river, the fact that he was wearing work boots, who knows how good of a swimmer he was, who knows what kind of shape he was in. All of these variables, there's literally 10, 20, 30 variables to be considered as to whether the man's skiff could have saved them. And I believe those variables render it pure speculation as to whether or not Bins could have been saved, assuming that Brandt had a duty to comply with the regulations. The Melchers decision. Melchers is easily distinguishable, not only on the issue of control, the right to direct and control the activities on the job site, but also because the holding in the Melchers decision is that a contractor has a duty to avoid injuring a worker caused by his own equipment. I don't think that by any stretch of the imagination can a reasonable juror, a reasonable fact finder conclude that any of the equipment supplied by Brandt Construction was a cause of Mr. Bins' fall. The plaintiff's argument is simply that, well, the tie plater was on the bridge, and like all animate objects, the tie plater had mass. And because it had mass, you couldn't just walk right through it, you had to step around it. And because you had to step around it, that increased the risk that you would trip and fall. Now, Bins was not stepping around the tie plater at the time of his fall. That's undisputed. The plaintiff tries to get around this by bringing in restatement, or Section 321 of the Restatement of Torts. I don't believe that has any applicability here. I've been able to find any case law adopting Section 321 of the Restatement of Torts, which holds that, according to the plaintiff, all he needs to do is show that the tie plater increased the risk of Bins falling. And the plaintiff says that, well, he had to bend down and stand up to operate the tie plater. Well, even if the tie plater was not in use, if Bins was tie plating by hand, he still would have had to bend down and stand up. So the tie plater did not increase the risk of instance falling, and it cannot be concluded that the type plater in any way contributed or was the proximate cause of Mr. Binz's tragic fall. I think I addressed the argument already regarding our contractual duties, and if the court has no further questions of me, I'll sit down and yield to
Thank
Mr. Drummond.
All right, counsel. Three and a half minutes, sir.
With respect to the functioning of the Brandt foreman, I would refer the court to the section, page 7 of the district court's opinion, where in rejecting the lone servant doctrine, the district court wrote that it didn't apply, quote, particularly when, as here, the company has provided a foreman in a leadership capacity with laborers. And so I think the district court properly drew the reasonable inference from the evidence that the Brandt foreman had authority over the Brandt employees and the Brandt equipment. And nobody testified that the Brandt foreman did not have authority over the Brandt employees or the Brandt equipment. What they did say was that the overall, the commander-in-chief on that job site, the person that the Brandt foreman reported to, was a railroad supervisor. But that doesn't mean that the Brandt foreman did not have authority over the Brandt employees or the Brandt equipment. And in fact, the Brandt, the rates charged by Brandt, Exhibit J of Supplemental Exhibit, the Brandt foreman was, it was $28.50 an hour.
Okay.
The other points I wanted to make, Judge, are that in the Melcher's case, the wheelbarrow was not defective. It was just that there was the use of the wheelbarrow because the contractor, the defendant contractor, knew or should have known that use of its wheelbarrow by the co-workers of the plaintiff. It wasn't even being used by the defendant's employees. It was like in this case it was being used by, it was the defendant's equipment that was being used by plaintiff's co-employees. It increased the risk of harm. Here the risk of harm was that here was a bridge with big holes in the side. There was a risk of harm in using this equipment that people would fall through that hole, as happened, and that triggered a duty to take care to alleviate that risk. If nothing else, the federal regulations apply the standard of care. And Illinois law, Illinois cases over and over again rely on federal regulations to show the standard of care, even if the federal regulation like OSHA does not create a private cause of action. The Section 321, I think, is just articulates, as a restatement should, the holding of the Melcher's case. And as for the proximate cause analysis, that's a question of fact for the jury. I would ask the court to draw all reasonable inferences in favor of Pamela Binz and resolve all facts in favor of her for resolving summary judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your help. We will proceed to case.